Hurry into Menards right now and save big money. Miracle-Gro raised bed soil helps you grow bigger, more bountiful plants. It provides the right foundation your plants need to thrive with a 100% organic formula that requires no mixing. Add Miracle-Gro raised bed soil to help your plants grow with organic nutrients you can count on. Visit our garden center or check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
This video is an independent investigative analysis based on publicly available documents, declassified intelligence records, and historical precedent. It is intended for educational and discussion purposes only. No claims are made regarding definitive guilt or factual certainty. Viewer discretion is advised.
JonBenet Ramsey, a name the world will never forget. A six-year-old beauty queen found dead in her own home hours after her parents received a ransom note. But this wasn't just any note. It was too long, too detailed, too rehearsed. A ransom demand that didn't read like a demand for money, but a message meant for someone else. The amount? Too specific. The phrasing? Too calculated. The handwriting? A contradiction in itself. Some say it was staged. Others believe it was something far more sinister. But the real question is, if this wasn't a ransom note, then what was it? Because once you see what's hiding inside this letter, you'll never look at this case the same way again. It's the morning after Christmas, December 26, 1996, Boulder, Colorado. The Ramsey house is still wrapped in decorations, a perfect picture of wealth and status. Inside, something is horribly wrong. Patsy Ramsey wakes up early, walks down the stairs, and stops cold. On the steps, a ransom note. Not a quick demand for money. Not a scrap of paper in frantic handwriting. This is 2.5 pages long. She screams, calls for John, calls 911. Before police even step through the front door, this case is already spiraling into chaos. Boulder PD arrives within minutes, but from the start, nothing about the scene makes sense. The house is massive, but no one checks all the rooms. There's no forced entry, no broken windows. Police treat it as a kidnapping, not a potential crime scene. Detectives don't seal off the house. Friends, family, even the family's pastor walk in and out, contaminating evidence. And the most critical mistake? No one finds JonBenet. She isn't discovered for another 7 hours. When her own father finds her in the basement. Let's stop right there. If this was really a kidnapping, how does that make sense? The ransom note demands money, but the body is still inside the house. No one took her. No one attempted to collect the ransom. This is where the case should have been simple. A ransom note means a kidnapping, right? But there was no kidnapping, and that's the first major problem.
Oh yeah, totally normal, you know. Just your standard 2.5-page, overly dramatic ransom note in a case where there's no actual ransom. Happens all the time.
By the afternoon, detectives aren't buying it. A real kidnapper wouldn't leave a body behind. Our real ransom note wouldn't be written on paper from inside the house. Our real crime scene wouldn't look this staged. So if the ransom note wasn't written to demand money, then why was it written at all? A ransom note is supposed to be simple, fast, urgent, direct. We have your daughter, pay us or else. But that's not what this is. This is a 2.5-page letter, a 370-word manifesto, carefully worded, filled with odd phrases, contradictions, and so many red flags, it might as well be a crime scene itself. The second red flag? Police quickly realized the ransom note wasn't brought in by an intruder. It was written inside the Ramsey home, on Patsy Ramsey's notepad, with a pen from inside the house. And not just one version. Investigators find practice drafts, as if someone sat down, tested out different wording, then committed to a final version. Now think about that for a second. A kidnapper breaks into the house, takes the time to sit down and compose a long, detailed letter, leaves the victim's body behind, but still delivers the ransom demand. That's not a kidnapping. That's a performance.
Because nothing says high-stakes abduction like pulling up a chair, cracking your knuckles, and workshopping your ransom note like it's a screenplay.
Most ransom notes are short, a few sentences, maybe a paragraph. This one, 370 words. It reads less like a ransom demand and more like a carefully crafted narrative. And then there's the tone. Experts say it doesn't fit. It waffles between polite and threatening, formal and dramatic. We advise you to be rested. Use that good Southern common sense. We are a small foreign faction. This note feels rehearsed, staged, like someone trying to sound like a kidnapper rather than an actual kidnapper. The third red flag? This ransom note isn't just strange, it's familiar. Several lines mimic dialogue from movies. Dirty Harry, Ransom, Speed, films where kidnappers demand money, issue threats, and play mind games. So, is this note just badly plagiarized ransom fiction? Or is it a script? The fourth red flag. The note demands $118,000. That's a weirdly specific number, until you realize something. John Ramsey's Christmas bonus that year? Exactly $118,000. How would an intruder know that? A ransom kidnapper doesn't demand the exact amount of the victim's bonus. That's personal knowledge.
Yeah, real criminal masterminds demanding an oddly specific amount of money that ties directly back to the victim's family. What's next? Leaving their business card at the scene.
The fifth red flag? At the end of the note, the author writes Victory SBTC. What does that even mean? Who signs a ransom note like this? What kind of kidnapper demands money, signs off like a supervillain, and then just leaves without collecting? And let's not forget the body was found inside the house. So what was the point of this note? Then, the final nail in the coffin. If this ransom note was real, then the entire crime makes no sense. If they wanted money, why kill JonBenet? If they never planned to take her, why write the note? And if the note was just a distraction, who was the distraction for? This wasn't a message to the police. This was a message to someone else. But who and why? A ransom note is supposed to be simple, a demand, a threat, a transaction. But this note, it's too long, too weird, too staged. And that's where a new theory emerges. What if this wasn't a ransom note at all? What if it was a cipher? Not a demand for money, but a coded message delivered in plain sight. Experts say the wording is unnatural, not like someone speaking under stress, but like something being dictated. The phrasing feels forced. The way words repeat feels deliberate. Some sentences are overly dramatic, like dialogue from a bad crime thriller. The note starts formal. Listen carefully. We are a small foreign faction. Then suddenly it turns polite. Use that good Southern common sense. Then it turns outright theatrical. Don't try to grow a brain, John. It doesn't read like something written organically. It reads like a performance. Linguistic analysts have noticed certain words are repeated in strange ways. You appears 8 times. Ensure appears multiple times. Uncommon for casual writing. Some sentences are weirdly redundant. Then there's the capitalization. Some capital letters don't match normal sentence structure. Some seem out of place, almost emphasized. Is it just bad writing, or are these markers? Some cryptographers believe this isn't just a note. It's an acrostic cipher. If you pull specific letters, rearrange keywords, or apply a simple cipher technique, a second message could be hiding beneath the surface. Some words have extra letters, almost like they were padded for a reason. Other words seem oddly structured, as if certain letters needed to be in certain places. If this was just a demand for money, why add complexity? Unless the real message wasn't meant for John Ramsey. It wasn't meant for the police. It was meant for someone else, someone who already knew how to read it. Some researchers believe the ransom note wasn't a ransom note at all. It was a prearranged message, not to demand money, but to send a signal. Think about it. If this was a simple crime, why write a full narrative? Why reference movie dialogue? Why use code-like phrasing that doesn't match a typical ransom note? Unless the real purpose wasn't to demand money. Unless it was to deliver instructions. But to who? If this ransom note was a cipher, it raises terrifying questions. Was it a signal to an accomplice? Was it a message confirming the crime had been carried out? Or was it a warning to someone powerful to keep quiet? One thing is clear, this wasn't just a simple ransom note. And if it was a code, then whoever it was meant for, they got the message loud and clear. A ransom note is supposed to be a demand, a clear, direct threat. This note, it's something else. It's long, erratic, overly dramatic, and yet certain words and phrases feel precise, deliberate, and that's when researchers notice something unsettling. Some of these phrases, they aren't random. They resemble intelligence communications. Not a ransom demand, but a coded message. The note ends with victory, a phrase commonly used in covert military operations and psychological warfare messaging. Intelligence analysts have pointed out phrases and structuring techniques that resemble encoded communication. Some words feel like signals, markers that might mean something to the right reader. And here's where it gets chilly. Several phrases in the note have direct connections to intelligence, covert operations, and military training. Let's break this down. We respect your business, but not the country it serves. This is not standard ransom note language. This phrasing is structured exactly like Cold War era disinformation tactics. Soviet psychological operations used nearly identical wording to create paranoia about foreign infiltration. Real life parallel? Declassified KGB communications used phrases like, "We appreciate your efforts, but not the cause you support." You can try to deceive us, but be warned that we are familiar with law enforcement countermeasures and tactics. This reads like a direct warning to authorities. Intelligence analysts noted this resembles spy tradecraft language used in covert instructions. Real-life parallel? In the FBI's declassified Cold War case files, double agents were taught to use phrasing that specifically warns of counterintelligence tactics as a coded way of signaling their own training. Speaking to anyone about your situation will result in your daughter being beheaded. Cartel and terrorist organizations have used this phrase, but never domestic ransom cases. The only recorded case of beheading threats and ransom demands are tied to terrorist and deep criminal networks, not small-time kidnappers. Real-life parallel? CIA monitored cartel ransom letters from the early 1990s used this exact structure. Any deviation from my instructions will result in the immediate execution of your daughter. This isn't just a threat. It's an exact replication of military-grade PSYOP structuring. The U.S. military's own psychological warfare training manuals include wording almost identical to this, designed to establish absolute compliance through structured fear. A real-life parallel? Operation Phoenix in the Vietnam War captured Viet Cong operatives reported that similar structured threats were used to break resistance in prisoners. You will withdraw $118,000. I advise you to be rested. This phrasing is oddly formal and structured like operational orders. CIA internal memos from the 1970s use the same structure when giving coded withdrawal instructions in covert financial operations. Real life parallel? Declassified espionage letters from Soviet double agents also used unnecessary passive phrasing. We advise you to be rested as a means of embedding meaning without drawing direct suspicion. Listen carefully, the opening phrase. Standard CIA and KGB covert operations manuals specifically instruct operatives to begin sensitive communications with attention-getting imperatives like listen carefully or read closely to immediately establish seriousness and urgency. Real-life parallel? The CIA's Simple Sabotage Field Manual, declassified from World War II, frequently opens covert instructions with phrases like listen carefully, designed specifically to grab immediate attention from field operatives. We are a small foreign faction. Classic Cold War era covert ops often deliberately misrepresent their size and origin. Small, foreign, independent faction, to avoid attribution, planting confusion about their true identity. Real life parallel? CIA's Operation Ajax in Iran 1953 involved sending communications labeled as originating from independent foreign factions, deliberately vague to prevent direct attribution to intelligence agencies. Don't try to grow a brain, John. Direct personal threats referencing specific individuals by name, using informal or insulting phrasing, are outlined explicitly in psychological warfare tactics. Such language deliberately destabilizes the target. Real life parallel? FBI counterintelligence training materials in the 1960s, COINTELPRO, instructed agents to personalize and insult targets. For example, don't get clever, don't grow a brain, to provoke emotional responses and compliance. Follow our instructions to the letter. The U.S. Army Field Manual on Psychological Operations explicitly uses the phrase follow instructions to the letter to induce absolute compliance, signaling that deviation is not tolerated and indicating military discipline behind the phrasing. Real life parallel? Declassified psychological warfare instructions during Operation Desert Storm in 1991 warned Iraqi military units with almost identical phrasing, quote, follow these instructions precisely. you stand a 99% chance of killing your daughter. Intelligence training emphasizes precise statistical threats using percentages or odds to create mental paralysis and fear-based compliance in hostage or negotiation scenarios. Real-life parallel? Declassified FBI hostage negotiation protocols from the 1980s and 90s advised negotiators that presenting exaggerated yet specific statistical probabilities, for example, 99% chance, can effectively paralyze rational decision-making in adversaries. Victory, SBTC. Acronyms or initials concluding a message are common covert sign-offs, signaling authenticity to insiders while appearing meaningless externally. Real-life parallel? CIA internal communications, like declassified MKUltra memos, ended with cryptic acronym signatures, now known to represent operational codes or specific handler instructions, indecipherable without context or training. Make sure that you bring an adequate-sized attaché. Use of overly formal and bureaucratic language, for example, adequate-sized attaché, parallels Cold War intelligence instructions, frequently incorporating unusual formality to subtly indicate covert instructions hidden within innocuous terms. Real-life parallel? Declassified GRU, Soviet military intelligence, messages from the Venona project used formal diplomatic terms, i.e. attaché, portfolio, as code references to secret courier instructions. You are not the only fat cat around. Targeting class resentment or economic position, i.e. fat cat, mirrors documented Soviet-era psychological warfare designed to exploit class divisions and social resentment within targeted populations. Real-life parallel? KGB's Active Measures program used exactly this phrasing in propaganda literature aimed at undermining confidence in Western corporate and political elites, as seen in the Mitrokhin archive. Law enforcement countermeasures. Direct references to law enforcement countermeasures indicate operational familiarity with specific counterintelligence and investigative techniques. Such references strongly suggest intelligence training or direct operational experience. Real-life parallel? The FBI's declassified Cold War-era counter-espionage manuals specifically warn agents about adversaries who openly reference familiarity with countermeasures, highlighting that such references indicate sophisticated training or agency affiliation. Why does this ransom note read exactly like intelligence communication? The note shifts between casual, polite, and aggressive. It sounds off-balance, almost staged. It reads like it was designed to distract. This technique? It's actually common in psychological operations. It's called confusion messaging. In espionage, intentionally inconsistent phrasing can be used to obscure a real message. Sometimes, messages are written strangely on purpose to bury a code within them. If this note was meant to signal someone else, its bizarre structure would be an advantage, not a mistake.
Let me get this straight. You're saying the weirdest ransom note in history might not be a ransom note at all, but a coded message? Yeah, that totally doesn't make this more terrifying.
If this was a real ransom note, why was it so theatrical? Why was it written in the house itself, on family paper, with a family pen? Why did it demand the exact amount of John Ramsey's bonus, down to the dollar? Why did it use military-style phrasing in a domestic crime? One theory suggests this wasn't a note for ransom at all. It was a signal to someone who already knew how to read it. Some believe the note was never meant for John Ramsey, but for a third party. A way to confirm something had happened. A way to signal instructions, which raises a terrifying possibility. If this was an attempt to send a coded message, did something go wrong? Was JonBenet's death an accident in the middle of something bigger? Or was it a warning? Think about it. If this was a simple kidnapping, why was the ransom never collected? If this was a staged crime, why does the note read like a military cipher? Either way, this wasn't a ransom. And if the note was an intelligence-style communication, who was meant to receive it? If this was an intelligence-style message, that means the author wasn't just some criminal. They were trained. So let's ask the next question. Who actually wrote this note? The words on the page tell one story. The handwriting, that's an entirely different mystery. From the moment experts analyzed the ransom note, something was off. The handwriting looked shaky, unnatural. Some letters appeared deliberately inconsistent. The pressure varied dramatically, as if the writer was forcing an unnatural grip. And that's when the real question started. When investigators examined the note, their first suspect was Patsy Ramsey, JonBenet's mother. And at first, it looked like a match. Many of the letters were formed in the same style. The capitalization and spacing had similarities. Even the way certain loops and flourishes were made seemed to align. But then, the contradictions appeared. Some strokes were completely different from Patsy's normal writing. The pressure was all over the place, inconsistent with a natural handwriting sample. Some letters seemed deliberately altered, as if someone was trying to mimic her style, but not perfectly. And that's when experts split. Some forensic analysts swore the likelihood was high that Patsy wrote it. Others completely ruled her out. How is that possible? Because the writing itself, it doesn't behave like a natural handwriting sample. The way certain letters are formed, they don't match normal muscle memory patterns. The shaky quality, it looks like someone was forcing themselves to write unnaturally. Some letters are inconsistent, as if two different people wrote different parts of the note. Handwriting analysts pointed to these anomalies. The letter A is written in two completely different styles, suggesting more than one writer. The way T is crossed changes throughout the note. Some are sharp, others curved. The pressure changes drastically, as if a different hand took over at times. Was this written by multiple people? Some experts believe so. Others raise the more disturbing possibility. What if the person who wrote this wasn't the true author? What if they were writing from dictation? What if the instructions were being given in real time? What if the inconsistency comes from hesitation, because they were trying to write in someone else's voice? This isn't speculation. It's a real forensic technique used in criminal investigations. When someone is forced to write a dictated statement, their handwriting often becomes erratic, unnatural, and pressured. Forensic specialists have noted that ransom notes written under duress often contain contradictory letter formations, as if the writer was struggling to keep it consistent. Handwriting disguise techniques used in espionage often involve subtle changes in letter structure to prevent identification. Was this ransom note the result of forced dictation? Or was someone deliberately trying to stage it, mimicking a suspect's writing just enough to create confusion? Some researchers noticed an eerie similarity between the letter formations in the ransom note and historical espionage handwriting samples. In classified intelligence training manuals, agents were taught how to alter their natural handwriting just enough to avoid forensic tracing by changing the slant, pressure, and letter loops. The U.S. Military Psychological Operations Handbook even includes methods for producing disinformation documents with fabricated handwriting patterns designed to look similar but not identical to a target. Is this what we're looking at? A note that wasn't written naturally? A note that was either forced or strategically altered? A note that intentionally throws off forensic analysts?
so the handwriting is kind of Patsy's, but not really. The strokes don't match, but somehow they do. And we might be looking at either an intelligence operation or a bizarre ransom note rehearsal. Yeah, this is totally normal.
Here's the thing about handwriting analysis. It's not DNA. It's not fingerprints. It's an interpretive science. And that's exactly why the results have never been definitive. Some experts insist it was Patsy. Some say it's not her at all. Some suggest multiple hands were involved. And here's the real question. If the handwriting points in multiple directions, then was that the point all along? So we know the note is suspicious. We know the writing doesn't quite add up. We know the entire case is tangled in inconsistencies. So what was this crime actually about? Was JonBenet's death really just a tragic murder? Or was it something more? It's one thing to lay out theories. It's another to ask how much of this actually holds up. The JonBenet Ramsey ransom note is real. That much isn't up for debate. It's one of the strangest, most scrutinized pieces of evidence in true crime history. But after decades of analysis, experts are still arguing over what it actually is. The note is one of the longest ransom notes ever recorded. 370 words. It was written inside the house using materials from the house. It contains bizarre phrasing, unnecessary details, and an unnatural tone. The ransom demand was oddly specific, $118,000, the exact amount of John Ramsey's Christmas bonus. The handwriting was analyzed by experts and they couldn't agree on a match. To this day, no other ransom note in history looks anything like this. Let's be clear, something about this note doesn't make sense. But here's where things get messy. Handwriting analysis is not DNA evidence. It's subjective. Experts have contradicted each other. Some say Patsy Ramsey's handwriting was similar. Others say it wasn't a match at all. The writing itself appears staged with inconsistent letter formations and pressure variations. Some experts believe more than one person wrote it. That means the handwriting alone can't prove anything. Some researchers believe the note contains hidden messages, unusual structuring, repeated phrases, and deliberate markers. Certain words and capital letters suggest possible encoding. However, no confirmed decryption has ever cracked a hidden message. Could there be a code? Maybe. Has it been solved? No. The wording is unusual for a ransom note. Some phrases resemble military-style psychological operations. The tone shifts dramatically, from polite to threatening to oddly formal. Certain terms like victory and law enforcement countermeasures are not typical of kidnappers. Did the author have intelligence training? We can't prove it, but the phrasing is suspicious. The point of a ransom is to get money in exchange for a hostage. The body was never taken anywhere. JonBenet was found inside the house. The money was never collected. The threats in the note never happened. So if this was never about ransom, then what the hell was the note actually for?
So we're left with two options. Either this was the dumbest ransom demand of all time, or it wasn't a ransom demand at all.
What if the real message of the note was never meant for us? The murder of JonBenet Ramsey is one of the most infamous crimes in modern history. But what if we've been asking the wrong question all along? From the beginning, the world has asked, who killed JonBenet? But maybe the real question isn't about who. Maybe it's about why. Maybe this wasn't about JonBenet at all. Because once you start looking beyond the crime itself, beyond the theatrics of the ransom note, and beyond the bizarre inconsistencies in the case, you start seeing something else entirely. Something bigger. Something hidden in plain sight. JonBenet's father, John Ramsey, wasn't just a businessman. He was the CEO of Axis Graphics, a high-tech computing firm specializing in advanced software and in imaging systems. Axis Graphics wasn't just any company. It was a subsidiary of Lockheed Martin. Lockheed Martin is one of the biggest defense contractors in the world, deeply connected to classified military projects, surveillance systems, and cutting-edge technology. This wasn't a mom-and-pop operation. This was a company with direct ties to the U.S. government, intelligence agencies, and secret defense projects. So let's ask the uncomfortable question. Was John Ramsey involved in something bigger than the public ever knew? Because if so, that changes everything. A normal ransom note demands money and tells you where to drop it. This note, it wasn't a negotiation. It was a statement. The amount demanded, $118,000, was oddly specific. Yes, it was the exact amount of John Ramsey's annual bonus. But why? If you're an ordinary kidnapper demanding a random ransom, why not round it to $120,000 or $200,000? Why use such a precise, traceable number? Some researchers believe the number itself was a signal, a message coded into the amount. Not for John Ramsey, but for someone else. If this wasn't a real ransom, then what was it really saying? If John Ramsey's business was just another tech company, there would be no reason to suspect anything more. But this wasn't just a tech company. Axis Graphics worked in advanced computer imaging, secure data processing, and software that could have had military applications. Lockheed Martin is one of the biggest names in aerospace, weapons development, and classified projects. So now, let's look at this from a different angle. If John Ramsey was connected to something classified, could this have been a message, a warning, a way to silence someone? Because here's the thing, if this was an inside operation, an intelligence-style play, then nothing about this crime was random. And maybe JonBenet was never the target. Maybe she was the collateral, an operation gone wrong. Think about it. If this was just a simple break-in, why stage a theatrical ransom note? If this was a botched kidnapping, why was the ransom never collected? If this was an outsider, why was there no forced entry, no signs of struggle, no missing valuables? Unless this was something else entirely. An intelligence operation, a hidden threat, a message disguised as a crime. And somewhere, someone knew exactly what it meant.
Oh sure, totally normal. Just your average six-year-old murder mystery with hidden messages, government ties, and an intelligence-style ransom note, because that happens all the time.
Instead of asking who killed JonBenet, maybe we should be asking what was really happening in that house that night. Because if the real crime wasn't the murder, but something deeper, then maybe the truth isn't just hidden. Maybe it was never meant to be found. The following segment is a speculative analysis based on publicly available information, open source research, and personal opinion. It is not presented as fact, evidence, or expert testimony. I am not a law enforcement officer, an investigator, or legal professional. This content is intended for thought exploration and open discussion only. Viewers are encouraged to think critically and form their own conclusions. Let's drop the polite language. JonBenet Ramsey's murder was not some botched kidnapping or a tragic domestic accident. This wasn't a story about greed, jealousy, or family dysfunction. This was an op, a psychological operation, targeted, precise, and brutally effective. And it wasn't about JonBenet. We've been chasing shadows in the wrong direction for nearly 30 years. Pageants, parents, intruders, BDI, RDI, IDI, etc. But once you understand the rules of covert operations, PSYOPs, and counterintelligence doctrine, everything about this case suddenly snaps into place. Because JonBenet Ramsey was not the victim of a random murder. She was the calculated centerpiece of an intelligence-grade psychological operation. And what happened inside that Boulder mansion on Christmas night was a message, executed with surgical precision and dressed up to look like chaos. Let's break it down by motive, operators, method, and psychological strategy, one section at a time. This wasn't personal, it was strategic. The objective was threefold. First, deliver a message. Not just to John, but to anyone else orbiting the same high clearance projects. A message loud enough to echo through the corporate corridors of Lockheed Martin and its intelligence clients. Second, create a media black hole. What guarantees massive media saturation better than the mysterious murder of a six-year-old beauty queen? This was the perfect smokescreen. Once JonBenet became tabloid fodder, nobody was looking at Axis Graphics. Nobody was looking at what the company was working on. Nobody was asking what systems might have been compromised. Third, trigger psychological devastation. Killing John Ramsey would have sparked a corporate investigation, but killing his child? That guaranteed emotional collapse, lifelong trauma, and compliance. This wasn't about erasure. This was about control. Let's be clear. This was not just a murder. It was a calibrated psychological and operational strike. The ransom note wasn't about money. It was a cipher, a psychological handshake meant for trained eyes only. A field communique, masquerading as nonsense. Three key clues. The note was bizarrely long, over 370 words. This is not standard criminal behavior. In intelligence terms, it's known as noise padding. Deliberately bloated content to embed layered messages, confuse pattern recognition, and misdirect analysis. The phrase, "We respect your business but not the country it serves," that's not ransom language. That's the language of geopolitical threat. A direct shot at Lockheed Martin's relationship to U.S. defense supremacy, possibly signaling a breach, defection, or internal sabotage warning. The amount demanded, $118,000. The exact amount of John Ramsey's Christmas bonus. That's not coincidence. That's signal embedding. Proof the perpetrators had internal access to financial data and household routines. And the key twist? Patsy Ramsey likely wrote the note, but not willingly. The handwriting analysis wasn't definitive because it wasn't meant to be. The inconsistencies are exactly what you'd expect from someone writing under extreme duress, possibly with a gun to her head or her child's life hanging in the balance. In tradecraft terms, this is dictation under coercive control, a psychological warfare tactic designed to induce lifelong trauma and plausible deniability simultaneously. She was following a script, literally, not from a criminal, from someone far more trained. Let's talk about the note. This wasn't some rambling scribble. It was a psychological weapon crafted to confuse, overwhelm, and conceal. Patsy Ramsey wrote the note, but not by choice. The handwriting inconsistencies, the near match to her style, that's what happens when a terrified mother is forced to write a note under duress, dictated by someone trained in psychological manipulation. She wasn't composing, she was transcribing. Every detail was deliberate. References to movies? psychological camouflage. The oddly specific ransom amount of $118,000, exactly John Ramsey's bonus that year, a chilling sign, which meant, we're in your house, we're inside your life. The contradictions and misdirection? Classic active measures strategy. Receipts? Declassified CIA behavior training documents emphasize the effectiveness of plausible authorship notes to psychologically break down a subject and confuse law enforcement. It's a form of PSYOP handwriting hijack, weaponized penmanship. This kind of op doesn't come from amateurs. It has all the hallmarks of a tiered, compartmentalized intelligence operation. Let's go scenario by scenario. Scenario A, an internal intelligence faction warning. Rogue elements within U.S. intelligence, or even a deniable private contractor, carried out the hit as a form of internal discipline or message to Ramsey's circle. The U.S. intelligence community has long outsourced sensitive work to off-books operators. Think Operation Phoenix. Think Iran-Contra. Think plausible deniability with teeth. Scenario B, corporate espionage strike. Foreign adversaries or rival corporate intelligence groups, possibly tied to Russia or China, may have seen Ramsey as a national security node. The line in the ransom note, "We respect your business, but not the country it serves," sounds less like a criminal and more like a geopolitical adversary drawing a line in the sand. Scenario C, domestic black ops containment. The most chilling theory, a black budget domestic faction silencing or punishing Ramsey for something connected to surveillance tech, AI imaging systems, or classified leaks. If John Ramsey or someone close to him had access to sensitive systems, this was the cleanest way to shut it all down and ensure no one would ever speak again. Now let's break down the roles. This wasn't just one person. This was a coordinated effort, and every piece had its purpose. First up, the planners and architects. High-level operatives or cutouts working on behalf of a compartmentalized black budget program. This includes ex-intel agents, military contractors, or foreign intelligence with state-level resources. Next, the execution team. Likely 2 to 3 operatives with intimate knowledge of the home, the family schedule, and law enforcement protocols. These weren't burglars. These were surgical operators. Then the ransom note handler, the dictator. A psychological warfare expert trained in behavioral science and cryptography dictated the note to Patsy, either in person or via prior coercive setup. The facilitators, possibly someone inside the family's inner circle or community, neighbors, family friends, like the Steins, or corporate associates, providing intel, routine data, or home access. Then the cleanup compromise team. Operatives ensuring any investigative leads were buried or defanged through influence on local law enforcement, media steering, or evidence mishandling. Why not just kill John? Well, killing John Ramsey would be straightforward and direct, but it might not achieve the psychological outcome desired. Eliminating an adult target directly might quickly be rationalized as a corporate dispute or professional hit, easier for the public and the intelligence community to compartmentalize and move past. But a child, especially one as high profile as John Benet, is emotionally devastating. It breaks down psychological barriers instantly, permanently traumatizing the target, John Ramsey, the family, associates, and community. Receipt? Declassified CIA and KGB psychological warfare manuals emphasize targeting family members, especially children, to create permanent psychological damage and lifelong compliance or silence. Operation Phoenix in Vietnam documents explicitly describe leveraging threats or actions against families as highly effective psychological tools. Now let's get tactical. Maximum psychological damage. A dead CEO? It's business. A murdered child? It's lifelong obedience. Everlasting message? Well, every anniversary, every photo, every headline, the message isn't forgotten. It's seared into the target's psyche. We control your legacy. This is how far we'll go. Do not cross us again. A receipt? Mafia, cartel, and intelligence agency intimidation tactics regularly involve family targeting precisely because it produces lasting psychological compliance and ensures enduring reminders of vulnerability. CIA files, for example, Operation Mongoose in Cuba, Operation Condor in Latin America, demonstrate explicit consideration of psychological terror messaging using threats against loved ones. Then, permanent distraction. Had John been killed directly, investigators would quickly turn toward his professional life, probing Lockheed Martin, Axis Graphics, classified contracts, or possible espionage angles immediately. By killing JonBenet and leaving a bizarre ransom note, operatives effectively controlled the narrative. Law enforcement, media, and the public instantly fixated on domestic angles, family suspicion, sensationalism, child pageants, and tabloid-friendly speculation. The murder thus became a noise factory, permanently burying the original intelligence motive beneath layers of confusion and speculation. Receipt? Intelligence tradecraft manuals, for example in the CIA, MI6, KGB, FSB, explicitly detail controlled confusion and misdirection tactics. Declassified Soviet KGB active measure strategies state clearly, public fixation on domestic scandal is ideal camouflage for covert geopolitical operations. Then there's plausible deniability. Killing JonBenet ensured a plausible cover. Domestic crime, kidnapping gone wrong, familial violence, all believable scenarios. These theories distracted police and investigators from intelligence and espionage angles. A direct assassination of John Ramsey would almost certainly trigger immediate FBI, NSA, or CIA involvement. The carefully staged crime scene ensured permanent ambiguity, allowing operational planners plausible deniability, minimizing investigative scrutiny into their networks and avoiding direct intelligence community blowback. Receipt? CIA clandestine operations guidelines, i.e. family jewels documents, stress plausible deniability as key. Using indirect violence, family targets, staged domestic crime, is explicitly discussed as optimal to reduce risk of detection, attribution, and retaliation. Permanent leverage and compliance, the ultimate warning. JonBenet's murder became permanent emotional leverage over John Ramsey and others involved professionally. Direct threats or assassinations might prompt aggressive retaliation or investigation, but threatening or harming children permanently instills deep-rooted fear, ensuring absolute silence and compliance going forward. This is textbook emotional blackmail strategy, amplified exponentially by public trauma. Receipt? FBI hostage negotiation tactics confirm threats to children ensure near total compliance. Soviet-era GRU, military intelligence, interrogation manuals state explicitly that threats or violence against children produce the strongest compliance behaviors from targeted subjects. It seems counterintuitive. Why publicly pursue justice if John allegedly knows or suspects a darker truth? Here's why this actually makes sense strategically and psychologically. Maintaining innocence and plausible deniability. If John suddenly stopped cooperating or advocating for the investigation, public suspicion would intensify dramatically, risking deeper inquiries into his life, work, and connections. By openly advocating for justice, he maintains a narrative of innocence, making him appear as a grieving father who genuinely wants answers. This acts as a shield, preventing suspicion that he might know something deeper. then attempting to uncover the real perpetrators, without directly exposing himself. If Ramsey suspected intelligence involvement, he'd likely never openly accuse a powerful shadowy network. Doing so would risk retaliation. Instead, by publicly pursuing the investigation through legitimate channels, i.e. law enforcement, independent investigators, private detectives, he hopes to indirectly put pressure on those responsible without making direct accusations that might endanger him or his surviving family. Then seeking emotional and psychological closure. Even if Ramsey understood what the murder truly represented, his relentless pursuit might also be personal. Losing a child is unimaginably traumatic. He could be psychologically driven by the desire to find peace or accountability, regardless of what he suspects privately. He might desperately hope that something will surface through public investigation that confirms his suspicions, finally freeing him from uncertainty, or a form of personal resistance or defiance. If John knew his daughter's murder was an intimidation tactic or message, his continuous public pressure might be a subtle form of defiance, showing the perpetrators they didn't entirely silence or intimidate him without directly naming them or putting himself in danger. Dragging this out publicly for years seems exhausting and counterproductive. But from an intelligence operation victim's perspective, it might serve critical purposes. For example, keeping the case alive as a form of protection. The continuous spotlight ensures attention stays focused publicly, providing a form of protection. If something happened to John Ramsey or his family after the murder, it would raise enormous suspicion. His ongoing campaign for justice ensures a constant public eye, ironically, creating a shield of safety. Also, slowly unveiling the truth indirectly. If he suspects the truth involves powerful entities, Ramsey might believe gradual, careful pressure is safer and more effective than a sudden revelation. Dragging the investigation out could slowly erode secrecy, creating cracks where hidden truths might eventually surface safely. Also an obligation to JonBenet's memory. Ramsey could feel genuine parental obligation, compelled morally and emotionally to keep searching for answers, even if deep down he suspects he knows the ultimate truth. Stopping the search entirely might feel like abandoning his daughter's memory. This part seems contradictory at first. If the murder was an intelligence-driven warning related to John's professional role, wouldn't the company protect him instead of firing him? Well, actually, firing him aligns perfectly with intelligence operations logic. If Ramsey's work at Axis Graphics, the Lockheed Martin subsidiary, involved sensitive classified or compromised projects, the company would quickly distance itself publicly. Firing him would be immediate damage control, cutting ties to avoid further investigation into sensitive corporate or government projects. Then removing a compromised asset, a security risk. Intelligence or defense companies are ruthless about security. Even if Ramsey was a victim rather than directly compromised, the murder meant he became an enormous security risk. Foreign or domestic intelligence adversaries could exploit his tragedy, blackmail him, or continue targeting him to extract further information. To Lockheed and its affiliates, Ramsey's continued employment after this incident would pose an ongoing security threat. Then there's making him appear less credible, a character assassination. By firing him, the company indirectly implied professional wrongdoing or negligence, effectively discrediting him. It made the narrative less about Lockheed's sensitive projects or connections and more about Ramsey's alleged personal issues. Again, misdirection and plausible deniability. And then there's completing the intimidation. The firing could have been the final element of the original threat, demonstrating total power and ensuring Ramsey's absolute silence and compliance by showing him how quickly his life, career, and reputation could be destroyed. Was Patsy aware of the truth about that night? Likely, yes, at least to some degree. Her role has been debated for decades. But here's the brutal truth. She wrote that note because they made her. The likely truth? Patsy was woken up that night, possibly at gunpoint, handed a pen and a dictated note, and told to write every word exactly as ordered, or her daughter would be killed. Then, they did it anyway. Given the complexities of the staged crime scene and a ransom note, Patsy almost certainly became aware, at least partially, of deeper layers beyond the official narrative. Even if she wasn't initially informed or involved directly, it's virtually impossible that John could manage the emotional aftermath, police questioning, and intense media scrutiny without Patsy picking up inconsistencies or subtle truths. For example, behavioral alignment. Patsy's behavior consistently aligned with John's narrative from the beginning, suggesting at minimum a shared awareness of some hidden context or threat that required them to be unified in public. If Patsy realized this murder was an intelligence-driven threat, going along with John's unified story would be the safest possible move to protect Burke, herself, and her extended family. Coerced silence, whether explicitly threatened or implicitly understood, is common in intelligence intimidation tactics. Receipt? Declassified FBI-CIA interrogation manuals confirm that threats against a victim's children or family ensure absolute compliance and silence, especially in mothers, who statistically show strongest protective responses. Then there's mutual survival strategy. Patsy and John publicly being in lockstep ensured minimal risk of law enforcement or media discovering deeper intelligence-related motives. Diverging stories would have triggered suspicion and deeper scrutiny, potentially uncovering truths dangerous to their survival. Receipt? Psychological studies by FBI Behavioral Analysis Units, BAUs, clearly demonstrate suspects who maintain unified narratives, even under extreme pressure, often share an awareness of a higher stakes threat scenario, forcing them into mutual cooperation. Then psychological denial or cognitive dissonance. Patsy may have been psychologically unable or unwilling to face the full scope of the truth, preferring to align fully with John's simplified narrative as emotional survival. Her alignment with John's story might have been driven partly by denial and the desperate need for normalcy amid overwhelming trauma. Receipt? Well, documented trauma studies from the American Psychological Association indicate victims of extreme threats frequently choose to believe simplified narratives over confronting unbearable truths, especially parents whose children have been violently harmed. That level of trauma is unrecoverable. She lived the rest of her life carrying that moment inside her, forced to perform in public, while knowing the truth was so dangerous it couldn't even be whispered. Her health collapse, emotional volatility, and eventual death from ovarian cancer all align with long-term trauma-induced deterioration, a pattern well-documented in victims of high-stress psychological operations. Receipt? Multiple psychological studies link prolonged trauma, stress, and repression to adverse physical health outcomes, from the American Journal of Psychiatry. John Benet Ramsey's murder is unsolved because it was never meant to be solved. It was a message delivered with surgical cruelty to a man embedded in America's black budget machine. And that note, it was meant to be a permanent open wound, a warning, a signature. A message that echoes through the corridors of defense contractors, corporate espionage networks, and deep state operators. It wasn't asking for money. It was saying one thing. We are inside the house. We know everything. And if you ever step out of line again, this will feel like mercy. You want to understand what happened to JonBenet Ramsey? Stop thinking like a detective. Start thinking like an intelligence operative. Because the real case, the one that matters, was closed the moment the note hit the staircase. And every year we keep looking for the wrong killer, We proved the operation worked exactly as designed.
And finally, there are some other suspicious angles that deserved brief mention. They are as follows.
Number one, JonBenet's medical records. Missing or classified. The angle? Early reports indicated some of JonBenet's medical records were unavailable or incomplete. Missing medical information often emerges in intelligence-driven cases as evidence of hidden trauma or external involvement. Why it matters. Intelligence agencies or black ops teams frequently suppress or remove medical evidence to prevent revealing methods or motivations. Receipt? CIA KGB historical records show routine removal or alteration of medical data following covert operations involving physical harm or experimentation, i.e. MKUltra Operation Midnight Climax. Number two, phone records and surveillance data. They were conveniently missing or ignored. The angle? Did police thoroughly investigate phone communications or digital surveillance around the Ramsey home on the night of the murder, or was crucial data conveniently missing or unexplored? Why it matters? Intelligence operations typically involve electronic surveillance before and after the event. Missing or ignored digital records strongly suggest external interference or complicity at higher investigative levels. Receipt? FBI and CIA declassified wiretap scandals, for example, Operation Shamrock, Carnivore surveillance program, consistently involve manipulation, suppression, or disappearance of key telecommunications evidence. Number three, the bizarre police mishandling. The angle? The Boulder Police Department famously mishandled the crime scene. Was their incompetence truly accidental or deliberately instructed from above? Why it matters. Intelligence-influenced investigations often deliberately sabotage crime scenes to prevent real discovery, ensuring permanent confusion. Receipt? FBI's COINTELPRO operation repeatedly involved instructing local police to mishandle politically sensitive crime scenes to ensure permanent confusion and deniability. Number four, Patsy's sister, Pam Palf. The angle? Patsy's sister was allowed to enter the crime scene to collect personal belongings, reportedly removing items such as JonBenet's pageant costumes and personal diaries. Why this matters? Allowing removal of potential evidence immediately after a murder is unheard of in standard investigations. Intelligence-influenced operations regularly authorize removal of sensitive items, i.e. diaries, personal effects, to prevent potential leaks of covert or sensitive information. Receipt? CIA's family jewels documents indicate common instructions for operatives or family members to remove sensitive personal items immediately after covert operations or unexpected fatalities to avoid exposure. Number five, sudden appearance and disappearance of key witnesses, manipulated testimonies. The angle? Certain witnesses initially emerged with potentially critical testimony or insight, only to vanish, retract statements, or suddenly refuse to cooperate. For example, Linda Arndt's shifting narratives. Housekeeper Linda Hoffman Pugh's mixed signals. Why this matters? Sudden changes, disappearances, or intimidated witnesses strongly indicate external manipulation, coercion, or surveillance. Classic intelligence tactics. Receipt? FBI witness protection and CIA covert witness intimidation protocols consistently involve sudden witness reluctance, contradictory statements, or outright disappearances after sensitive operations. Number six, Lockheed Martin Axis Graphics surprising lack of investigation. The angle? Law enforcement strangely avoided deep investigation into John Ramsey's work at Lockheed Martin Axis Graphics. Unusual given the high-profile nature of the case. Why this matters? Intelligence-influenced cases commonly see key corporate or governmental employers, for example, especially defense contractors, quickly declared irrelevant or off-limits, even though normal investigative procedures would heavily scrutinize them. Receipt? Historical precedent. after suspicious deaths related to defense contractors, for example, Marconi scientist deaths, companies were frequently declared off-limits or investigations quickly dropped, later revealed as intelligence-directed suppression. Number 7. Burke Ramsey's silence and protective behavioral. Angle? Burke Ramsey, JonBenet's brother, remained notably quiet publicly. Was his silence strongly enforced by the parents or others due to direct threats or explicit instructions regarding the danger of speaking? Why this matters? Sustained silence from surviving siblings strongly indicates parental or external coercion threats or protective instructions common in intelligence intimidation scenarios. Receipt? FBI profiling guidelines suggest long-term enforced family silence or narrative alignment strongly indicates external coercion, typically associated with high-level threats or intelligence tactics. And number 8, sudden closure of certain lines of inquiry. The angle? Detectives who attempted deeper inquiries into sensitive angles, for example, corporate links, foreign intelligence possibilities, private contractors, were quietly reassigned, discouraged, or discredited. Why this matters? Intelligence-influenced investigations consistently shut down sensitive lines of questioning, especially regarding corporate or intelligence agency connections. Receipt? COINTELPRO and MKUltra investigation history demonstrates how FBI and CIA routinely pressured or threatened local police and detectives away from sensitive lines of questioning. This case has haunted the public for decades. It's been called the most infamous unsolved murder in modern American history. A little girl, a wealthy family, a bizarre ransom note, and an investigation that never made sense. And yet, maybe that was the point all along. Because in most cases, we assume the truth is out there, waiting to be found. We assume if we just dig deep enough, connect the dots, or follow the evidence, we'll eventually get to the answer. But what if that assumption is completely wrong? What if, from the very beginning, this case was designed to be impossible to truly solve? The contradictions, the chaos, the evidence that leads everywhere and nowhere at the same time. We were meant to see everything, but never understand anything. Governments, intelligence agencies, and power structures sometimes don't need to hide the truth. They just need to bury it under layers of conflicting stories. They don't erase the mystery. They make it impossible to decipher. They let the public look at the puzzle, but never allow them to put the pieces together. They flood the story with so much noise that no one can agree on what's real. And if that was a strategy here, it worked. Because the more you investigate the case, the more it falls apart. The ransom note reads like a cipher, but no one can crack it. The crime scene was either staged or sabotaged, maybe both. The investigation? A circus of misdirection. And at the end of it all, nothing actually makes sense. That's cognitive overload. It's a psychological warfare tactic. If you give people too much conflicting information, they stop being able to tell what's real and what's not. In this case, it's the perfect example, Exhibit A. So ask yourself, what if we've been asking the wrong questions all along? What if the ransom was never about money? What if this wasn't just a murder, but an operation? What if JonBenet's death was never meant to be solved? Because solving it would reveal something we were never meant to know. And here's the part that should truly keep you up at night. What if this wasn't a cover-up of a crime, but the crime itself was the cover? In short, we were meant to be obsessed. We were meant to keep looking. We were meant to chase the illusion of solving it. But we were never meant to see the actual truth. And that leaves just one final question. If this case was designed to be unsolvable, then what were we never supposed to find? That's it. That's the end of the episode. But the mystery, that never truly ends. We were given a crime that doesn't make sense. A ransom note that doesn't act like a ransom note. A case that refuses to be solved. And yet, decades later, here we are. Still searching, still looking for something buried beneath the noise. I'm Ralph, that's Wendell, and this is Divergent Files. If this one got your brain buzzing, hit like, subscribe, and drop a comment. Not because it pleases the algorithm, which, let's be honest, hasn't exactly been kind to channels like this, but because you keep this show alive. And if you really want to go deeper, join us on Patreon. YouTube doesn't cover any of this. Not the research, not the production, not the hours spent chasing mysteries that most people will ignore. It's just us and you. So if you want extended episodes, behind-the-scenes chaos, and access to the stories too wild for the main channel, head over to patreon.com/divergentfiles. Oh, and we're officially on podcasts. Divergent Files Project Podcast is live wherever you listen. So if you ever need to question reality while driving, working, or avoiding small talk, we've got you covered. At the end of the day, this channel isn't just mine, it's yours. Your theories, your curiosity, your wildest ideas, that's what keeps this going. Got a mystery you want us to crack wide open? Drop it in the comments. I read them all. The world is strange. The stories even stranger. So stay curious, stay kind, and remember, you are truly appreciated.
Now, if you'll excuse me, I need to go stare at my walls for the next 5 hours and rethink my entire existence. This case is going to haunt me forever.